Welcome.
ようこそ。
Bienvenue.
आपका स्वागत है.
Bienvenido.
환영합니다.
Welcome.
Welcome to Keep Connected. I'm David Siegel. In today's episode, we are talking to Dr. Marissa G. Franco. She's a psychologist. She is a professor at the University of Maryland. She's the author of the New York Times best-selling book, Platonic, and she is a true expert in adult friendship. If you care about that, which I know each of you do, listen closely. Dr. Marissa G. Franco, welcome to Keep Connected.
Thank you so much for having me here. It's such a pleasure.
And you have been like a friend of Meetup for a while. You hosted a Meetup Live, had over 4,000 RSVPs and thousands were listening to it afterwards, YouTube, etc. You're a top writer on Psychology Today and other places on adult friendships, the author of the blockbuster New York Times bestselling book, Platonic, like huge success with Platonic, and I'm just so happy for you on it. I have to ask, just to get us started, my understanding is that you actually use Meetup as well. Love to hear a little more about that.
Sure. Yeah. So I was in Mexico City. I wanted to connect with people. I knew it doesn't happen organically. I have to put myself out there as a friendship expert. You know, don't just wait for it to happen. So I attended a Meetup group, and I think that was a really good idea because when you attend a Meetup group, you are self-selecting into a group of people that are ready to meet people, and your chances of success of connection are so much higher. And so I attended this like language exchange. It was like, you know, Spanish speakers and English speakers, and I met a guy there, Jose, and I brought my friend David, and then we all ended up going to Lucha Libre at the end of the week. And I just had this like, there was eight of us at the Lucha Libre match. And, you know, some of them that I had met just from going to that one Meetup event.
Woo! You know, I always have believed that the absolute best use case for Meetup, and there are many, but the best is when someone is new to a city. You, your journey, when people focus to the extent that you have on friendships and building friendships, were friendships easy? Were they challenging as a kid? How were they as a young adult? I feel like there has to be a story or experience in there based on what you do today.
Yeah, it's a great question. So I almost say proudly mediocre at friendship before I wrote Platonic, because I think a lot of times people are like, when it comes to friendship, you have the skills or you don't, and you have to be like a natural, when I think it's a learned skill. And that's why I wrote Platonic. But what really inspired me to write the book was that in my young 20s, I went through this breakup. I decided to start this wellness group with my friends where we are practicing wellness together as a way to kind of heal from the grief. So, you know, we were cooking, meditating, doing yoga, and it was life-changing for me. And it wasn't the yoga or the cooking. It was just the community, being in community with people I love who loved me every week. And it made me question some of the beliefs that I had about romantic love versus friendship that I felt like were really contributing to that grief. Like, romantic love is the only love that matters. Your worth is dependent on whether you have a romantic partner. If you don't have romantic love in your life, you don't have any form of love. So I just looked around at my friends and I was like, well, why doesn't this love matter? Why isn't this significant? And so I wrote Platonic because I felt like we had such an entrenched hierarchy of love, and Platonic love was always at the bottom. And I wanted to be part of the culture change in leveling that hierarchy.
How big was that community? Was it 3 or 4 people? Was it 8 to 10 people?
I think there were 6 of us.
Okay. Because, you know, I think it's important to recognize it doesn't have to be 10 to 15, you know, close loving friends. It could be just 1 or 2 or 3 even, and that makes all the difference. And was the relationship between the 6 of you, you know, tight between, or relatively tight between all members of the group? Or was it more you had a tight relationship with each of the 6? Meaning, how important is it kind of to have that web of friendship versus the one-on-one type relationships?
First, I'll say for anyone that might want to start such a group, one thing that I did to make it less intimidating was I approached one friend first, Heather. And when she was down for it, it was kind of like we were both co-leading. And so, you know, it's scary because you're afraid of rejection, but once you spread out the rejection, it's a lot easier. So whenever I want to like initiate something new, I always try to get buy-in from one person to kind of do it with me. Yeah. Yeah. And so then if you each have one person, you have enough people to already create this group. And for us, it was like each of us was friends with each other, but the group made us so much closer to each other, and it just gave us a group identity. So it became like sort of normalized for us to all hang out as a group, whereas before it was like we kind of hung out sporadically with each individual. And it, I don't know, I guess it just, when you have a group, you feel this sort of network of support, or even when you have a need, right? You can ask the entire group, and whoever has the capacity to give it at any given time can give it to you versus just having to rely on one person. And the research actually finds that if you do have more of a group where your friends know each other, then your friendships are more likely to maintain, because at that point, it's like one person in the group could reach out and everybody stays connected.
Yeah, it's a really good point. When there's some event, you all see each other automatically. It's not only on you to try to get each of those relationships together. And sometimes there's an interesting dynamic that occurs. And this has happened in my life and also my kids' life, where you introduce two people, you are friends, and somehow they end up becoming even closer friends than possibly you were. And sometimes that's hard for people, because when you have that group dynamic of 6, 7, 8 people, it's important not to have ego be right. A basis to that, because I think sometimes that can hurt group dynamics. Feel free to share more on that.
I agree. And the other thing I've learned about mixing friends, so I have like my very close friends, and then I have like my low dose friends, which is like we love each other at low doses, like once a month. And so one of the hazards of introducing friends can be, well, if they become friends, which you're not in control of, you might have to see each of these people all the time. So are you ready to see both people all the time? Like now I'm like, I'm going to mix the friends that I know I want to stay really close to, I don't mind seeing all the time, and be kind of intentional about who I mix. So yeah, I guess there's like a bit of art to the friend mixing. Like you kind of got to think through it a little bit and not just like do it haphazardly or automatically.
One more question about your personal experience. When you first had that romantic breakup, I don't know if that was devastating or just difficult, but you probably had no idea what that would open up for you and how that would dramatically change your life. And it's just such a great example for our listeners. And we've all seen in life that things that were the most devastating or challenging experiences could end up being just changing our career trajectory and changing our life trajectory. And it's just one time after another, I keep hearing stories like that.
Absolutely. And I think it helped me realize that for every loss, there is an offering. Like going from losing a romantic relationship to being single made it sound like I was losing connection. But we know from the research, for example, that single people spend more time with friends, tend to have more higher quality friendships. So in some ways, being single is the jackpot of friendships. So if you have a vacuum of connection in your life, it's not that there'll just be emptiness. It's that other types of relationships now have room to fill that space. And so I think, you know, as we go through life transitions, it's really important to recognize that every loss also has an offering, and to figure out what that is.
First of all, I've heard the concept has an opportunity, but I just love the verbiage. Every loss has an offering. Let's talk about that word and why you're using that word versus other words that could be used.
You know, I think it feels like a more emotional word, and it feels like maybe a more spiritual word. And I think there's something spiritual about loss and something spiritual about the identity change that kind of comes with it, where we come to know ourselves more deeply and we come to change maybe some preconceptions that we had about what we need to fulfill a happy and to have a happy and fulfilling life. So there's sort of this like deep recalibration that's happening that, you know, feels spiritual to me in the way that it feels kind of like transcendent. It feels like bigger than you. It feels like it connects you to meaning and it connects you to purpose. And so I think that's why the term offering in particular really resonates with me.
That's beautiful. Really beautiful. It feels so much more proactive that you could really do something about it. You could make an offering. In your writing, both in Platonic and other writing, you've done a lot of writing, which is really wonderful for fans like me. You talk a lot about good friendships and bad friendships.
Yeah.
And, you know, oftentimes people think of the term friendship as it's a good thing. All friendships are good. But it's not true. Some friendships cannot be good. And I don't know if they'd be called friendship or not. But how do you know if you're in a bad friendship? You know, the concept of breaking up with a friend. You know, help people to understand a little bit more about what a bad friendship is. Because you don't want to end it too quickly.
Right.
And all friendships have dynamics where there are some good parts and some challenging parts. So exactly. Share with us a little more on that.
So I think about, I was at a friend's wedding and my friend's husband, he had his bachelor party and half of his friends canceled last minute. Everyone had to pay $1,000. And he was talking about, you know, these friends that he was trying to keep in touch with. And in that moment, I was like, that's not friendship. Like, that's good company, not good friends. Like, good company are people you like and you enjoy spending time with them. But friendship is an investment and a responsibility. It's, I'm going to show up for you in those times. I'm going to follow through. Like, I'm going to be there for your happy moments and for your sad moments. It's intentioned and it's effort. It's not just liking who someone is. And I think we need to remember that so that we can hold ourselves accountable to our friends, because a friendship is a relationship just like any other. And so you need to try and you need to put in effort. And I come up against the ways that we sometimes dichotomize intimacy so much, where we think, oh, romantic relationship, this is what you do to be intimate. And a friendship, this is what you do to be intimate. And to be honest, there's a lot more overlap than there is differences. Like, just like you probably wouldn't want to cancel on your romantic partner last minute if you were going on a special vacation, you don't want to do the same thing to your friends. And so there is this like transferable property to intimacy. And I think we can use the skills that we learn in one relationship to help us get better at the other.
Yeah, I really believe that if you practice some of the principles that are in Platonic, it will directly help in your romantic relationships as well.
Totally.
And I think it's a really important message to understand. You know, I think about my best friend. So my best friend is my wife. How important is friendship, quote unquote, when it comes to marriage? Just because we're on the topic, I thought I'd love to hear more about that too.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think it's beautiful that your spouse is your best friend. And I think, you know, from a research perspective, it's a good idea because, for example, being married gives us a bump in our mental health, but being married to your best friend increases how much your marriage will improve your well-being exponentially. And, you know, I think sometimes people don't choose to be in romantic relationships with people that they wouldn't be friends with. They're like in a relationship with them, but they wouldn't want to be friends with them. When the research actually shows us that being friends with your partner, feeling like you have that sense of friendship, is related to how long the relationship lasts. It's even related to like how good your sex is. So it is, you know, it's funny that, again, we always dichotomize platonic and romantic love when platonic love is part of the foundation for what makes romantic love succeed. And so that's really, really great and really, really important. I think the only thing that I sometimes see, which I try to push back against, mm-hmm. is that have this narrative that one person should fulfill everything and that we
dangerous.
Yeah, exactly. And that's a narrative that hurts people in relationships because you're putting too much expectations on one person. They can't possibly live up to them. Whatever you do to improve your mental health improves your spouse's mental health. So we know that people, for example, that make friends outside of their relationship, not only are they less depressed, but their spouse is less depressed too. And so I think generally, I don't want there to be tension between platonic and romantic love, right? Like, I want us to understand, like, if you're in a relationship, it benefits your relationship if both people find friends outside of your relationship. It's not like, oh, you're spending time with your friends, you're not spending time with me. It's like, oh, you're spending time with your friends, now we can have more quality time together.
And just because some of your close friends love skiing, if your significant other does not love skiing, that's okay.
Exactly.
Or whatever thing there are there. And skiing is obviously an example of potentially dozens of things that people are complex and they have so many different parts to them. And I do see among my friends frustration at times that their significant others are not into certain things that they're into. And I think it's so myopic perhaps and dangerous, you know, in a relationship to put that kind of pressure. Obviously there should be some commonalities, but it's okay to even have significant areas of passion and interests that are very different than a significant other.
Exactly. Exactly. And I hope that those differences, instead of feeling like, oh, this means we're not compatible, it means, oh, now I know that I want to find friends that also share those interests with me too.
There's something incredibly special about friends that I've had since elementary school and since high school. I personally put a lot of effort into maintaining those long, long relationships, maybe because it's almost like family and because of the history there. Sometimes I put perhaps even too much of an emphasis on that, to the extent that I might even deprioritize closer friends or making new friends. Do you have a perspective on just old long friends? Is it important to put this kind of perhaps even pressure on myself to maintain those relationships, even if we've gone in different ways or not?
It makes me think of this relationship model by this researcher named Rustbelt's relationship model. And, you know, I think what the model gets at is that sometimes we think the only reason we stay in a relationship is how satisfied we are in that relationship. But in fact, there's three factors that really predict whether we stay in a relationship, only one of which is how satisfied we are. The other is, do we see us having alternatives? So if people have a friend from childhood, they feel like I can't make any new friends, they're likely to keep that friendship, even if they're not as satisfied in it. But the third thing is how much investment have you put into this relationship already? And so people really weigh how much history we have as a very significant factor in terms of determining whether they want to continue on in the relationship. And I think it is a resource. It's a resource because people you have history with expose you to sides of yourself that maybe have become buried as you've gotten older. They kind of remind you of who you were. And being able to reminisce with someone improves our mental health. It improves our feelings of connection. It's like you're traveling without leaving the space together. And so while I don't think investment alone, if there's no satisfaction in the relationship, is enough to keep you in it, I think it's also okay to acknowledge that this is part of the glue of our relationship, and that's okay. And that's even to be expected.
Oh, okay. I'm glad to hear it. I don't know if my old friends are glad to hear it, because I keep trying, but reminiscing is so powerful. You're absolutely right. Oh, the amount of joy I get in just sitting down with someone and talking about things that happened in the past. It's first of all, the reason why reminiscing for me is actually particularly helpful is I find reminiscing at times to also be reflective. In that you think about where you were back then, you think about where you are today, and you potentially could think about where you want to go, and you think about where you've worked on yourself, or maybe where you're not as strong as you'd like to be. And for me, reminiscing actually does help to accomplish that as well.
That's awesome. Yeah, it's interesting to think of it that way. It's almost like a marker of your success or your progress too.
Which potentially is nice, depending on the situation. Conflict. Conflict is healthy. Too much conflict is potentially not healthy, depending on the situation.
Yep.
Every friendship has small, tiny conflicts of, I thought we were going to get together, you showed up 15 minutes later than I expected. That's a tiny conflict. And of course, there's enormous conflicts that exist, you know, in friendships as well. I'd love to hear insight around the value of conflict in friendships, good conflict, challenging conflict, and anything around how conflict potentially could be a basis for also enriching friendships.
Yeah. So this was the biggest growth area for me. Before writing Platonic, I was like, I'm just going to try to get over it and be okay. And that's what it means to be a good friend, to try to get over it on your own. And you know, I read this study that found that having open empathic conflict contributes to more intimacy. I've read research that finds that people that really value relationships address conflict directly rather than trying to just ignore it. And they're more popular than the people that constructively address conflict. So it started to lead me to question some of my assumptions about conflict, which I was confusing conflict with combat. You know, like if I bring up an issue, it's going to be a fight. It's going to be antagonistic. And I should have realized, because I had to learn this in romantic relationships, that there's another way, that conflict doesn't have to be combative. But I think we so rarely are upfront about issues within friendships that sometimes it feels like we can catastrophize it. And so, you know, it took me learning how to do conflict with friends, which involves framing, which means you bring this up and say, I'm bringing this up because I love you and I want to make sure nothing gets between us.
Beautiful. That context setting is so important. Great. Keep going, please. So important.
You use I statements, like I felt hurt about this. You perspective take. What was going on for you at that time? You ask for your needs in the future. Maybe we can handle this way. What do you think? And so it's more like a reconciliation and a coming together than it is an attack. And I realized that it was kind of, I don't want to use the T word toxic because I feel like it's overused, but it was a bit toxic for me to be ignoring conflict because I thought that by ignoring it, it would go away. But instead, by ignoring it, I would just withdraw from people and not even give them a chance. And sometimes I had a problem with someone that wasn't actually true, or there was some extenuating circumstance going on. And it was like I was holding people guilty before giving them a trial. But for me, you know, I talk about attachment theory. I think out of all the different ways that you could be anxiously attached, this was the one I was most anxiously attached, which means I feared rejection and abandonment. And so I felt like if I bring this up, this person is just going to kind of leave me or abandon me. And so it took me instead understanding there's a possibility that this could just make us closer. Like it's like almost your prediction of how this could go has to be positive to will you to actually do it and do it in a way where you're not attacking someone. Because if you assume they're going to attack you and reject you, you're going to go in with that aggressive energy. And so now, you know, literally just this morning.
Yeah, let's hear it. Let's hear it.
I had a friend and she's a very close friend. And I invited her to my book launch for Platonic and she never responded. And the year before I had, drove in for her wedding, drove in for her bridal shower, flew in from Portugal for her bachelorette party. And I was just sort of like, this has hurt me that our relationship has existed at these different levels of investment. And I know you're such a loving friend in so many ways, but I haven't felt like, you know, there's been similar levels of effort. And I want to let you know, because I want us to be able to work through this and stay close. And she sent the most loving message in response. I'm so sorry. I love you so much. Like, this is not an excuse, but this is what's going on in my life. I want you to know how much I've been rooting for you, even if I couldn't be there physically. And thank you so much for bringing this up. And honestly, I just felt healed. And it was beautiful. And I realized that there are some forms of healing in relationships that you can't do alone. Like, you kind of need it to be a relational process of healing. Like, otherwise you're not, it's still going to be there. It's still going to be.
If you just meditated on that relationship, it would not have been the same, frankly.
Exactly.
As if you had that discussion. Beautiful. Beautiful. Have you had those discussions with someone else in the past? They didn't react the right way. And I imagine the best approach is it to continue, or is it to recognize this is not going to a good place? Time to just kind of shut this down. Because it doesn't always turn out the way that it just turned out with you.
It doesn't.
And yes. I'm sure you've had examples where it hasn't turned out that way. Maybe can you share an example of where it didn't turn out and then what you did in that situation?
I can, absolutely. So, you know, I have a friend and I think she just goes into fight or flight mode in conflict. And I realize that sometimes when people do that, we think that's who they really are. But when you're like hijacked and you're in fight or flight mode, I don't think that's who you really are. I mean, you know, it's basically your brain is being hijacked. You're in a state of like
you at worst in a time of stress that hopefully is only a small percentage of how you actually really are.
Exactly. And, you know, I didn't address that conflict in the best way either. I've kind of learned too with conflict, it's helpful to go in asking questions if there's any ambiguity rather than assuming your perception of the truth, like, oh, what happened in this situation? Instead of, I felt hurt that you did this, but like, hey, what was going on for you? So yeah, there were things that I did wrong too, and it didn't go well. I mean, there was no perspective taking happening. It was like, this is my point, this is your point. And so I talked to a friend about it, and she was like, if you still feel uncomfortable, the conflict isn't over. Like, it's still there. And so you almost have to kind of go back in the second time. So I had to think about what am I going to do the second time to make this better? And I was really wanting to go in and be de-escalating, like repeating back what she says and acknowledging her perspective and saying, you know, this is what I feel like is true. And this is the issue. This is how I contributed to this issue while still, you know, while not folding on what I needed as well. And so I did that in the second conflict. She was still pretty reactive. But at some point, I took a step back and I made a comment on our dynamic where I said, you know, friend, it feels like I'm really trying to like perspective take and understand your perception. And I don't feel like I'm getting that same effort from you. And she kind of realized that it was happening because she didn't even realize that it was happening. And that really changed the course of the argument where she was like, I don't want to be like my dad. I know he does that all the time. And you know, like I do want us to be able to talk about things and bring things up. And so, yeah, it felt very, I think before I did it, it felt very masochistic to be like, I know that this is going to be really hard, but here I am like jumping back into the fire. But, you know, I learned that you can influence people in conflict. You can't determine how someone reacts, but if you try to de-escalate, if you try to affirm them, tell them, you know, these things I love about you, even while we have this thing that stresses out, be responsive to them. Okay, I get that, you know, I didn't respond well in this way. I want to own that. You know, those are the things that can bring someone, hopefully pull someone out of that fight or flight mode a little bit.
Beautiful. And now you have a lot of fodder for Platonic Part Two, whenever that comes out. And hopefully it will at some point. I want to get to something that you do as well in your day job, which is working with companies. And you've talked and you've written a lot about the employee myth and employees feeling belonging to each other and belonging to the company. Obviously, that myth is broken in potentially irreparable ways, but to be decided. What are some of the ways in which you're working with companies? What are some of the things you're seeing about the relationship that companies have with employees, which has probably changed quite dramatically, especially with fewer employees coming into the office every day, especially in the tech space? Share a little bit more about that and friendships among employees, because, you know, remember, you know, there are CEOs that have gotten into trouble, actually, and they say, we're a family. Meetup is a family. No, no,
no,
you're not a family. Because exactly. If you were a family, you can't fire a family. So, So we're not a family. Let's just not say those things that are just absolute mistruths. But we can say that we have a community, and we can say that we have belonging, and we have friendships and relationships. But share a little bit more about that, and I'd love to hear data around the importance of kind of friendships and relationships vis-a-vis, you know, companies as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. So the employee myth is this term I use to describe how we think we get to work and our fundamental human needs are gone. Like being an employee replaces our humanness and we can just kind of clack away at the computer and we don't need to feel belonging or feel connection with people. And we know from the research that this is untrue. You know, for example, employees that are lonelier, they're more likely to miss work. They report poorer performance in work. When people are friends, their teams perform better. They're more creative, more innovative, more likely to stay in their job. And so I think for all of the outcomes that companies really want, connection is so important to achieving them. And in fact, there was one study that looked at, different factors that relate to workplace fulfillment, and connection was the number one.
Wow.
Number one most important. It's just people feeling like they're valued. They have good relationships. They belong somewhere. You know, even if people are doing jobs that they really love, if they don't feel valued, respected, and connected, they're going to leave those jobs. Because for us, like, being disconnected is a chronic state of stress. Like, that's what loneliness is. And it's going to impede your happiness, no matter how much you love the work you're doing. And it's going to impede your mental health. It's going to impede your physical health and your ability to do the job, because you're not feeling good. You're not feeling optimal. You're feeling like you're in a stress state. And so that is why I feel like it's so important for companies to think about how you can create connection amongst your employees. I know Google, for example, they start their meetings with like highs and lows, where people share like their, you know, high points of their week or low points of the week. And what is really important is that people stop talking about work. there's a study that found that the more time you spend together at work, the less close you feel. And my thinking is what might be happening is that people aren't their real selves. And when you're interacting in a role repeatedly over time, you kind of feel more inauthentic. And so giving people the latitude to be their real selves, doing just, you know, relational skills like affirming people, right? So these companies will, you know, they'll send you things for your birthday. They'll send you a gift card. They'll do like virtual lunch, things like that, like retreat with like all these fun activities, or even like, there's this term repotting, which is like changing the settings in which you interact, which contributes to connection. And so workplaces and employees trying to meet up with their friends at work outside of work, like let's go to a walk together. Let's go to this museum together. And or when companies do retreats, what really benefits them is their relationships are usually repotted. Like you're in a different setting that encourages less formality. And so, you know, those are some ways that we can really bring our human side to work. I'm very focused on it now because I teach and my students, I know that Gen Z, like the rates of mental health issues are like half of them meet criteria for mental health issues. So I also do things like every week we have a photo share where everyone shares photos that represent fun facts about them. And then my appreciation hat, which is like everybody brings one class, someone brings in a gift to give to someone whose appreciation or contribution they really appreciated in that class time.
I'm a professor too. I teach at Columbia University and I teach entrepreneurship and strategy. And as one professor to another, I have to ask, tell me about the name of the course. Tell us everyone about the name of the course now. First, start with that.
It's called The Loneliness Crisis, Origins and Solutions.
Amazing. Is that under psychology, sociology? What department would that be put under?
The honors program. So it's kind of interdisciplinary.
Oh, University of Maryland has an excellent honors program. Mm-hmm. I have quite a few friends that are in that as well. And do you think many of the students are taking that on for their own personal needs and interests?
Absolutely. Unfortunately, Gen Z is like the loneliest generation we've ever had.
So you're seeing that many of the students are taking it and they want to practice what they're learning as opposed to for purely academic reasons.
Exactly. And to be honest, I'm trying to change society through the course because, Okay, so one of my, I teach two courses. One of them, everyone became friends. The others, they didn't really hang out outside of class. And I was trying to figure out what the difference is. And I realized that one of my classes had someone that I call an igniter. The igniter turns to everybody and says, does anyone want to have lunch after class? And by extending that invitation, so many more people now feel connected because that one person was willing to ask. They create this infrastructure of, I mean, that's everyone who starts a meetup group is an igniter, right?
Yes, and so, absolutely right.
Yeah, my goal is, can we create more igniters, more people that are taking it upon themselves to create these infrastructures for connection? And that's what I hope the course will do.
By the way, I love that you said that just to connect it to companies. We have an employee, I won't say his last name, but his name is Trevor at Meetup. He is our cultural igniter. He will just send messages in Slack. Hey, I'm going to play volleyball. Who wants to join? Hey, we're going to have board games this afternoon. Who wants to join? He's an amazing kind of engineer, but on a whole nother level, he is this cultural igniter that has this meaningful impact on kind of, on the rest of the company. And as hirers of talent, which all companies do, hiring igniters can have such a enormous impact on driving culture and success in the company, more so even than a CEO or more so than a head of people, because it comes from the people as opposed to coming top down.
Exactly. I'm trying to formalize the igniter role and I haven't had so much success. I was like, you don't have to write this paper if you want to be the class igniter. And they're so afraid of rejection. So I'm experimenting with like, how do you create an igniter? Because I think, just like I said about connection, I think you can create things that people aren't just born this way. So I'm trying to figure that out. And maybe next time I'll tell you what my observations are.
Ooh, very interesting. Obviously, there are certain inclinations. Igniters are going to be more extroverted than introverted. They're going to be more organized. Value relationships. But those are things that can be learned. So I'm intrigued to hear more. Okay, quick questions, quick answers. Here we go. First time you saw yourself as a leader, Marissa.
Ooh, first time I saw. Oh, you know what? I was in high school, part of this group called the Adventure Crew, and we dog sledded and we did camping trips and ski trips and cabin trips. And I was the president of the Adventure Club. So that was it.
Shocker that you became focused on friendship when you had already being the igniter already in high school on your Adventure Club. Amazing. If you could access a time machine, go anywhere you want. At any time you want, where are you going and when?
You know, my favorite author, she's a Black intellectual named Bell Hooks. And I think she passed away in the last couple of years. But her book, All About Love, really taught me what love is. And she says, like, love is helping someone express their most deepest self, express the essence of who they are. And I think just thinking of love like that really changed my life. So I would try to have lunch with Bell Hooks.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Bucket list. What is on your bucket list that you you've done so many things. What is still left on that bucket list for you? It could be personal or professional. It doesn't have to be professional, whatever you prefer.
I definitely would love to live abroad again. So
again, where did you live before? Where did you live once?
I've lived in Trinidad and Tobago and Haiti. And my dad's from Italy. So he sent us to live with our family when I was younger. I've studied abroad in Florence. So home base, I think, will be DC, but I want to live abroad.
You've done so much and you're going to be doing so much more inevitably. What do you most want to be remembered by?
I'm not sure, but I will say I want to feel like I did this weekend when I was out at a social event and someone came up to me and they were like, Dr. Franco, I know your work. It's transformative for me. And it's the reason that I'm here at this social event right now. I was like, wow.
If you could help one person, if you could save one person, they say there's a saying that you could save the world. And that is a great example because that's one person that was at that event that built the confidence, built this tools and the skill set because of what they've heard and what they read from you. And the beauty of it is that there's tens of thousands, not hundreds of thousands of people that have done the same. You may not know who they are, but they're out there.
Yes.
And it's just it's a beautiful thing what you do. And thank you so much for sharing it with Meetup. And we just appreciate your continued friendship at Meetup. And you're also sharing with people that how helpful Meetup is actually for many people who are looking, to grow friends.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. And thank you so much for creating Meetup. Oh my gosh, the impact you have, vast, definitely impacted me too. So I really appreciated this conversation.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast with Marissa G. Franco. So many takeaways. I'm just going to share a few. Here are some golden nuggets. There's a big difference between someone who's good company and someone who's good friends. Focus on the good friends. The importance of igniters and the multiplicative impact that an igniter can have in a company or in a friend group. The importance of platonic love and how it makes romantic love ultimately succeed. And the saying that every loss has an offering. I hope that today's podcast was an offering for each of you. If you enjoyed today, then please subscribe, leave a review, and remember, let's keep connected because life is better together. David Siegel here, your favorite podcast host. I have something important to share. Check out my new book, Decide and Conquer, to really get to know my story at Meetup. The hardest thing about community leadership is making tough decisions when the stakes are high. And I'll tell you, they were never higher than when Meetup was owned and sold by WeWork. In my new book, Decide and Conquer, I'll walk you through a counterintuitive framework for decision-making and the epic journey of Meetup's surprising survival. Good leaders deliberate, great leaders decide. Order my book today by visiting decideandconquerbook.com or anywhere books are sold. Think you'll like it.